survived it. First Martian war of the early 20th century was a cataclysm. And yet, to minds far greater than our own and older even than the Martians, minds who regard our world from the cold outer reaches of space, that conflict must have seemed a trivial affair indeed, and unworthy. The further a world is from the sun, the older it must be, and cooler. Thus, the Earth is older than hot, fecund Venus, and Mars, austere and chill, is in turn older than our temperate globe. The outer worlds, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, are ancient indeed, and locked in the stasis of time and ice. But Jupiter, king of planets, more massive than the rest combined, older than Mars, as Mars is older than our world, and warmed by its own inner fire, is, must be, host to the gravest intellect of all. Not the words of H.G. Wells, but the words of Stephen Baxter, writing in The Massacre of Mankind, the authorised sequel to the 19th century epic by H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. And it's something I return to in terms of the contextual resonance and possibly relevance that this particular session is going to hopefully take you through over the next 45 or so minutes. I've entitled it proto-science fiction quite simply because this is a period in time where, as a genre in itself, the notion of scientific romances, scientific fiction, is really beginning to blossom. Those of you who in the third year choose to do the science fiction module with me will go back in time to look at the work of Mary Shelley, for instance. Even before that, Thomas More. There are all sorts of arguable lines in terms of when did this thing begin. But there are two particular critical writers and contributors that I particularly want to look at in terms of this whole notion of how what we now appreciate as science fiction was formed pretty much in the white heat of Empire, Edwardian literature, and indeed late Victorian period work as well. One of them, of course, is H.G. Wells, but of course the other one that I want to actually sort of reflect on today is Jules Verne. Verne was not a contemporary as such of Wells, although they were around at the same time. Most of Verne's work was done in the middle of the 19th century. But certainly this whole notion of adventures, extraordinary voyages, things which in our present time period manifest themselves in terms of the annual steampunk festival, extraordinary trips and various other things, borrow quite extensively from the essence of what Verne and indeed Wells obviously put together. This notion that Britain, the heart of empire, running pretty much effectively a third of the globe, was very much number one in the geopolitical scenario. Something which actually maybe we also tend to look back nostalgically on, particularly given the current climate and relationship with our European souls as well. But nevertheless, in terms of this whole sequence of how events develop, how did Herbert George Wells, who's up there, effectively become this founding father, in many ways, of what we now refer to as science fiction? In a period of 5 years, effectively produced pretty much the building blocks for what we now appreciate as science fiction. The Time Machine, War of the Worlds, Island of Dr. Moreau, and The Invisible Man. All produced by Wells, just part of his output, but again, very much focusing on the basis of extrapolating narratives from hard science. Wells himself was the youngest in his family and was not fortunate effectively to actually be going to school, etc. He actually was educated relatively late in life. He was influenced heavily by Aldous Huxley. And again, Huxley, very much a proponent of Darwin's theory of natural selection, there's an awful lot of scientific discovery and theories being purported at this particular period. Again, lots of controversy in terms of what those theories actually are. And certainly if we go to the autumn of 1895, when effectively the time machine is effectively developed and produced within that whole field. Wells' line, which actually takes real science, i.e. the notions of length, breadth, width, the dimensions, etc., and suggesting a fourth, which is something obviously Albert Einstein would continue to develop in terms of the whole notion of the relativity of space, time, and the continuum, was one of those imaginary thought experiments. If you drill down into the writings of Wells, a lot of it is speculation. And it's one of the things whereby he himself refers to himself as being a scientific philosopher. We'll come along to actually consider the end of the War of the Worlds, the epilogue, where he actually uses that phrase to actually start outlining his own position with respect to life. But inevitably, he's influenced at a certain level by our French explorer, Jules Verne. Now, Verne is often sort of lumped together, as I have today, with respect to Wells. Verne was very much a proponent of extraordinary voyages from the Earth to the Moon, journey to the centre of the Earth, around the world in 80 days, and so on. There are lots of theories which are actually quite fun to explore that suggest that actually one of the things he was actually doing in his writing was actually giving away an awful lot of cipher secrets of secret societies, the Rosicrucians and so on and so forth. And there are lots of connections with respect to that. Certainly, his text, written, as you say, about 32 years before Wells effectively starts getting his publishing sorted out, was dealing with this notion of exploration. And again, you've got almost the perfect storm for imaginative literature. You've got the Industrial Revolution, you've got scientific theories, you've got a sense of dominance in the global stage. It's really interesting that over the last decade or so, China has specifically started developing a whole range of science fiction writers and so on. And so on and so forth. How were these actually influences? How were they connecting with respect to what we see in Wells' work within The War of the Worlds and so on? Well, certainly, it's well worth noting that these were some of the contemporaries of both Wells and Verne. Victor Hugo, of course, known, of course, for Les Misérables, etc., philosopher Balzac, female writer George Sand, and the Franco-Prussian environment was actually there. So that whole notion of taking a thought, saying what would happen if, something which we tend to regard as being fundamental to contemporary science fiction, you're asking that question, what if? What would happen if, into this ordinary world, an anomaly was introduced? An anomaly such as an alien, an anomaly such as a technological development, an anomaly such as changing our own genetics, changing our own sort of aspects and so on. All of those things fitting into the brave new world, of course, as manifested by the United States of America, which, of course, one of the prime leaders probably in the 20th century of the genre of science fiction. But again, its roots are very much lying in that kind of European element of how these things are developed, outlined, and produced. And as I mentioned, secret societies, well, have they ever really gone away? I could tell you, but then obviously, etc., you know the rest. In terms of Freemasonry and what sort of things are being measured, the sense that you can actually read in different sort of levels, different layers of how things are developing. The notion, certainly in Verne's work, of having a senior figure accompanied by a junior figure in a kind of master-apprentice line, passepartout in Around the World in 80 Days. The characters of Nemo and influences in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, all sort of interconnecting with that notion, which is arguably echoed in George Lucas's Star Wars. You have the whole essence of the elements of Obi-Wan Kenobi, The Apprentice, The Dark Side, and so on and so forth. You get these kind of constant lines, constant narrative tropes coming through. And the sense that ultimately there are people who know more about what is happening in this globe than we do. That whole sense of the Illuminati, growth sort of factors. Again, these are things which kind of constantly appear and manifest in various ways, in various sort of lines, and so on and so forth. As indeed is the Rosicrucian philosophy. There are certain common elements that again work through that in terms of the influences. And Verne was very much a proponent of the notion, as indeed several people were, that actually we've already started exploring most of the planet. I mean, at this stage, we've gone beyond the voyages of Captain Cook in the 18th century and so on. The world, as we know it, has kind of effectively been mapped on the outside. But what about the inside? What about the hollow earth? The hollow earth, which in a sense, Wells goes on to echo when he starts talking about the Morlocks and the time machine. People living underground, people actually interconnecting on that sort of basis and so on. Certainly Verne was quite explicit in this, in his line, Journey to the Centre of the Earth. Again, one of the key areas that sort of started approaching that whole field. And that Anglo-French development, again, echoed in a number of texts of the time. If you reverse the letters to Air One, you're really getting the ultimate text, which refers to perhaps utopia, starting off with an N and ending in an E. You know, spin it round, you get nowhere. How does that actually sort of develop? Is it a mixture of kind of commentary on the society at the time? Is it a sense of end of century anticipation and so on? Or the sense that maybe we had taken technology as far as we can actually go? Again, how are things opening up and so on? And lots of kind of key areas. I mean, authors you won't have heard of, such as Harbin, Land of the Changing Sun. What I'm saying with respect to this is there were an awful lot of writers who were churning out adventures, scientific romances and so on, which possibly influenced Wells' writing. Certainly, he needed to make money, as most jobbing authors actually do. And certainly addressing the whole notion originally, The Time Machine, was written as a scientific paper about the changes and lines of time and so on. But actually it was deemed that it was better to use the medium to actually start telling a story, developing a fiction, which can actually address his own particular views and thoughts on humanity. And unfortunately, one of the things about Wells' thoughts is that there are many theories which suggest that actually his suggestion that ultimately it would be ideal if the world was governed by a group of benevolent, despotic, scientific philosophers often can be seen as arguably presaging the whole notion of the extremes of fascism and communism that kind of littered the 20th century with its challenges, etc. This sense that if only we can actually control these things we call human beings, if only we can actually look after them, we can actually sort of make sure that a better world is had by all. The moon pool again, you know, back end of the First World War, the Great War that we referred to. Clearly when Wells starts putting together the War of the Worlds and the Time Machine and his other texts, the notion of war, other than the Boer War, is something which basically, if there is any war, well, Britain's superior firepower will obviously lead to its success and its victory. And there isn't the suggestion that, in terms of how the narrative is progressing, that we would ever be defeated. But that consideration, again, the apocryphal tale that he's wandering through the fields of Surrey with his brother, and he's suggesting basically what would be the case if effectively there was to be an invasion by a technological force that was so amazingly advanced of us, advanced ahead of us, that we couldn't actually cope with the whole thing. He takes great delight in destroying whole swathes of the home counties, the home countryside. Again, it's interesting insofar as, you know, one of the standard narrative tropes of late 20th century apocalyptic invasion dramas, it's usually Washington and so on that tends to be taken out, New York. In other words, that centre aspect of where things are being developed and how they're put into place. And again, the notion of thinking being the best way to travel and the sense of utopia and its binary opposition, dystopia, in terms of basic structural understanding of these things, opens up. We are never really introduced to the Martians in War of the Worlds. We only see them ever as the enemy. And until, of course, they are beaten by the very microscopic life forms and bacteria that, in the infinite wisdom of the universe, were put on this planet to protect humanity and the Earth. But there is the sense that effectively they were coming from a dying planet. They were wanting to colonise. And certainly Britain's history with respect to colonisation was very much in the ascendancy at this particular moment in time. It was a way in which the British way of life could be exported both ideologically, industrially, and in a variety of ways to actually educate, quote-unquote, civilise, quote-unquote, the myriad of new races and elements around the globe. Expansionism is playing a great part in this whole system. But what about the reverse of that? The history of first contact, i.e. the first time that an alien species encounters another alien species, is fraught with challenges and difficulties. Whether you go back in time to what's happening in Central America with the Mayan civilization, or South America with the Aztecs and so on, and their first encounter with Europeans, where the flu could effectively wipe out an entire civilization, or they're completely decimated by various other areas. Whether you're talking about Native Americans, and again, what happened to the land there in terms of the expansionism, again, primarily of Western Europeans, or Australia, or Africa, and so on. So the kind of classic experiences that we were seeing, and that Wells would have actually understood, is if somebody's actually got more technology, you go into a less advanced situation, you will take it over, you wipe it out. Cultures have changed, often irrevocably. And again, there's a lot of discussion in terms of that. It's one of the reasons why, in the late 20th century, the writer and producer Gene Roddenberry came up within the Star Trek universe with the non-interference directive, that actually the clear allowing of civilizations to develop at their own pace was actually mandatory. You observe, but you do not interfere. Again, that might be an ideal, it might be something which is seen as something which is part and parcel of the whole thing, but it's something that Wells, in essence, doesn't really bother with too much, because he wants to get right to the plot. Characters in Wells's novels tend to be mostly ciphers. Wells arguably is somebody who really deals with the big picture. We don't even get the narrator named in The War of the Worlds. You know, it's interesting that BBC upcoming adaptation will obviously readapt it, putting in a whole range of things, including the actress Eleanor Tomlinson, and a variety of sort of key things within that whole system. But the sense of actually where we see the characters, they kind of are there. They're certainly not as well-rounded, one might say, as Jules Verne's characters, in terms of how he's using the whole system. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just, again, one of the kind of classic ways in which he's operating. It's interesting, though, that he was, Wells, part of a group at the time, Fabian Society, that also included many of the early suffragettes. And it's interesting that even on that basis, his roles for women characters are minor at best. You don't get many clear female characters developed within that whole system. Whereas, obviously, Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, again, pretty much masculine-dominated. But at the same time, you do tend to find out more about the world of Captain Nemo in both 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and in Mysterious Island and so on. Again, lots of developments within that whole field. The future is a different place. We've travelled in the future in the few moments you've been with me so far today. We can't go back. We can only go forward. Are we, as a nation of people, a group who actually stagger backwards into the future, looking longingly at the past? But the sense that actually Wells is talking about in terms of the War of the Worlds is, again, positing something in real time. It's that invasion fiction, the apocalyptic fiction that effectively sort of launches a whole new world. It's no surprise that Baxter, in collaboration with the H.G. Wells Society and so on, very much developed this whole notion of the massacre of mankind. He's seeing that whole notion of civilizations rising, civilizations falling, as a kind of circular aspect. That ultimately, these are things which will consistently happen and take part in the whole system. Verne, this was an interesting just aside really, produced a text which was very much focused on what the city of Paris would look like in the 20th century. Because his publisher thought it was so depressing, he basically sort of effectively said he can't actually run it. It didn't actually get published until literally just the back end of the 20th century, over 130 years after it had been originally produced. And we talked about, again, the journeys that come through, the sort of lines that Wells had been talking about, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to spend time, because we don't really have that amount to go into how the publisher Pierre Hetzel was a key influence on Verne's life. But in terms of the sort of aspects that we were getting, I do want to actually talk about the whole notion of the social and political revolutions that basically Herbert George Wells is a part of. As I said, he wasn't necessarily the brightest individual, but he did actually avail himself of the opportunity of sitting in lecture theatres, not too dissimilar to this one, Imperial College London, where he'd actually listened to minds, thinkers, philosophers of the time, etc., and would then begin to start saying, okay, how do we actually make sense of this whole life experience and so on? You know, in a situation where clearly you have, Disraeli coined it in the middle of the 19th century, divided nation, a divided society. How do you actually develop between the haves and the have-nots? You know, we're all fortunate as far as everybody here is intellectually relatively sophisticated. There are an awful lot of people who are actually out in the world who, as we're well aware, are offering bizarre takes on life, the universe, and various other bits and pieces. I won't sort of use any pejorative terms, but you think, where are we going? Does that give us any right there to consider ourselves to be an elite, an educated elite, and so on? Well, on one level, possibly. But then doesn't that also mean that there are responsibilities to ensure that actually the benefits of education, the benefits and the challenges can actually be shared throughout society and so on? And this development, which obviously Karl Marx is writing about in Das Kapital, the whole notion of Marxist philosophies, social philosophies, the notion of equality in general. Again, Wells is writing well before female emancipation, well before rights to vote are actually developed, well before the whole notion of equality is being developed. And don't even get me started in terms of obviously the challenges with respect to race relations and other elements as well. So his thought is very much seeing the notion of, as I say, the noble scientist as opposed to the noble savage. The scientist who effectively, because in science there's purity. It's none of this wishy-washy, well, it could be a 64, it could be a 67, it could be a... It's, you know, it's ultimately this sort of general thing of it is or it isn't. Admittedly, we've kind of even now moved on now. Most cosmologists, most physicists will actually say that fuzzy logic occurs, that actually the whole notion of a right answer is questionable. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, the fact that you can either be observer or observed, but never both at the same time. Is just one of the sort of aspects in which the whole strangeness of science is very much at the fore of where we are now. However, applying science, which obviously the Victorians did extensively within the Industrial Revolution, the development of obviously steam, the application of steam power, electricity, the generations from that, the telegraph, ways of communicating across huge distances, these were all clear, tangible ways in which science was improving society. It was making it better. Yeah, again, the whole notion of how we use it. I mean, the early computers are being thought about in that time. Ada Lovelace, Charles Babbage, other sort of, beginning to get this whole notion of a binary, etc. So therefore, if science is doing so much good, and will continue to do so, obviously, in terms of medicine, in terms of checking out that actually... the sewers of London are effectively built well and appropriate from that point of view, then why shouldn't you actually move to the next logical thing and say, well, why don't the scientists run everything? Well, Charles Darwin would probably agree. And Darwin's notion of the theory of natural selection, the sense that actually the fittest will survive, is something that, again, permeates an awful lot of cultures in a whole range of ways. But then you see, you get the whole notion of who actually decides who is the fittest. Who is the person who ultimately will say, okay, we'll make a selection. We'll develop various other areas. Who actually applies the eugenics aspect to, you know, what is appropriate? Should we even consider it? If we decided, well, you know, if we've got a sort of situation in which we want to eliminate... all people under 5'4", for instance. Okay.
problems. Oops, all right.
I'm not suggesting it as a recommendation. But there are lots of ways in which you can see, how do you define those kind of things? There are a whole range of sort of elements whereby there are suggestions that you can detect whether a person is going to be a criminal by the shape of their nose. You would have people who would actually sort of, you know, basically be collating details, go through her, because again, fingerprints, the science of fingerprints, the forensic science are coming through all day. I mean, again, the classic line, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. What else do we actually have in terms of the sort of sequence within this? Well, ultimately, scientific romances are part and parcel of why we enjoy that escapism. We quite like that notion of seeing things that are surreal, the literature of the weird, the sense that, I mean, H.P. Lovecraft was obviously taking things to a different sort of area. Also, you have a whole range of other writers who are opening up this whole system. And actually, the time period of 1890, arguably up until C.S. Lewis in the 1950s, and The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and the Narnia Chronicles, and so on. I'll just drop in a little comedic aside here, because I just... Why did Aslan cross the road? Narnia business. Okay, let's move on. Okay, part two. So, back to the whole notion of how do we actually have this whole essence of successors to Wells in terms of how things are going. Shh. Arguably, even one of our favourite Time Lords, individuals, Doctor Who, owes a great deal to the writings of H.G. Wells. In fact, there's an episode called Time Lash in the 1980s in which the Doctor actually meets H.G. Wells, and there's a kind of riff on various other sort of lines as the Traveller and so on. Because in the Time Machine, actually, the Traveller remains, again, anonymous. I've already talked about the whole essence of steampunk as a genre which has developed, which has evolved, which in many ways, again, has its roots in Lincoln. It's the biggest steampunk festival in Europe every September that's actually held from that point of view. And if we actually turn once again to War of the Worlds, the thing I've kind of woven in to the system together, think about the cultural context. Think about the fact that at this particular period of time, it's not the end of empire, it's not the end of the First World War. We haven't had that experience that so impacted Kipling. The Rudyard Kipling pre-World War I, or pre-Great War, and the writer Rudyard Kipling afterwards, huge differences. The whole notion of the author of If and so on changes completely, partly because he lost his son in the First World War. And that impact, which obviously 100 or so years ago the nation had actually gone through, had a major effect, a major impact on the psyche. And then, of course, it happened again 20 years later. Now, that wasn't the case with respect to when Wells is writing War of the Worlds. This is a period, actually, where, in terms of the development, you very much got the sense that, as I say, Britain is leader of the world. And I go back to that line. Colonies and colonists. How are they actually seen? How are they perceived? How are things actually viewed? You know, the notion of going to civilize the natives, going to effectively better yourself, looking after India, looking after South Africa, looking after which other part of the world is. You know, you're part of that whole cultural hegemony that actually carves up the globe in ways that you actually want to work through. And inevitably, you have these sense of strange new lands. We went all the way back to the 13th, 14th century, the sort of medievalists and so on, and we look at the Mappa Mundi in Hereford Cathedral. The sense that there is this kind of landmass on the other side of the planet, because it's not sort of confirmed, maybe, right, that are the antipodes, the antipodeans, people who basically whose feet actually would walk backwards because they'd be the opposite of where we'd actually walk forwards and so on. And that whole development, which obviously led the way to voyages of discovery and changes. I mean, when Captain James Cook left Teesside, Cleveland, back in the 251 years ago now, with the first voyage of the Endeavour, you know, his brief was to actually explore and discover and hopefully ensure that there was a claim made to land masses that they believed existed, as I say, on the other side of the globe, etc. So Australia, New Zealand, and so on. But the other thing which is very much in that sense of what we refer to as science fiction elements is the sense of the alien. We know how we are by knowing what we're not. So you see a situation in which, you know, the scary nature of the war machines, the technology and so on, clearly not what we are. Or are we? Are we just as bad as that in terms of when we actually sort of look after various... And is this just a case of, in a sense, that whole revolution of the wheel, etc.? That the whole sense of how the alien other nature is there. And again, there's a lot of concern within the late Victorian period, early Edwardians, about things like immigrants, migration, the fact that London's too small to cope with all these incoming Italians and Eastern Europeans and Irish and so on and so forth. The rhetoric remains the same in terms of how things are seen from that point of view. And just as Bram Stoker, very much you can read the novel Dracula as a thinly veiled metaphor for fear of the unknown, fear of the other, and so on. And I've already talked about the whole essence that historically, first contact scenarios don't usually work well. You could argue that the ones which work perfectly are the ones we don't even know about. But that's, again, open to speculation, discussion, and so on. Likewise, America is always there. America had had its Civil War. It also assassinated its president, Lincoln. But it was coming slowly but surely to begin to emerge on the world stage. Awful lot of Wells's fans and readers were actually in North America and so on. And that whole sense of where things are going. Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Again, it's an exercise in time travel, although time travel by unconsciousness, mind and so on and so forth. But again, it's echoing some of the key things that we're talking about in terms of what we now refer to as science fiction. And actually, again, within America, the whole essence and the drive in the early 1920s is to really start promoting the whole essence. The Hugo Awards effectively all comes from the whole notion of the astounding science and imaginary science, etc. War of the Worlds was Wells's fourth novel. And I've already spoken about Darwinism, but it also tied in very much with the whole ideas of astronomers and the essence that actually were there or could there ever be seen to be canals or indications that life on Mars would actually be there and that problems would actually be sort of taken within that whole field as well. Interesting enough, Baxter's line quotes from Percival Lowell, writing about Mars, "If astronomy teaches anything, it teaches that man is but a detail in the evolution of the universe, and that resemblance, though diverse details, are inevitably to be expected in the host of orbs around him. He learns that, although he will probably never find his double anywhere, he is destined to find any number of cousins scattered through space." So there is the sense that actually it would be extraordinarily naive to say that we, on the planet Earth, were the sole life in the universe. You know, again, we've gone around that big sort of paradigm shift in terms of seeing humanity as being centre of the universe, and then peripheral to the universe, and then and so on and so forth. But how do you actually view that whole system? And that's at the heart of Wells' notion that, okay, what would happen if Mars, obviously a much older planet, coming to the end of its tenure, showing signs of civilization, said, it's time to actually move on. Lots of people, Kim Stanley Robinson being one of them in recent years, kind of talk about the fact that actually we could become the Martians because as we terraform Mars and we leave Earth behind, we move on to other planets and so on and so forth. War of the Worlds is also presented as a factual narrative. It's presented to us by a journalist. You've got to trust journalists. They're all wonderful. They're all right, truth, etc. But it is that whole sense of how we are presented with the way in which this narrative is unfolding. From the initial scientific background to how we encounter the alien landings in the first place and so on. And even the adaptations, whether it's the 1950s movie of the same name, whether it's the Orson Welles radio adaptation in 1938, The Night That Panicked America, because an awful lot of Americans believe that it was genuinely happening, that actually Mars was invading because of the dramatization of the whole package. But then, allegedly, 62% of Americans believe in alien abduction. Well, possibly. Look at the president. In terms of the sequence, you've clearly got a range of sort of other elements coming to the fore, including obviously the Tom Cruise movie, which obviously updates War of the Worlds extensively. If one was asked to sum up for Amazon or on site or tweet or whatever the whole essence of War of the Worlds, probably that phrase would say it. Now that could be damned with faint praise, you know, because there's not a great deal of laughs in terms of War of the Worlds. It does have minimal characterization. But it's ultimately the idea, the development of the idea, and how that idea is proposed and outlined that really sort of Wells excels at. You know, it's that whole notion, which is, again, painting with broad brushstrokes, wide sort of concepts and so on. And it does open up that whole area for something which even the Warhammer universe probably sort of develops in its own way, this whole essence of invasion fiction, the notion that ultimately being up against the enemy, in which we can obviously sort of thrive and survive. In many ways, you could say that the expansion of zombie movies and so on also has elements that relates to that whole sequence too. A little bit of a backdrop there in terms of how the thing developed. Again, as I said, Wells is a jobbing writer. He wants to basically make sure that he is earning a living and a core and something that actually could support his lifestyle and various other things. And I'm not going to go into Wells' lifestyle, but it was interesting in a number of sort of ways, etc. You can look it up, use all sorts of delights within that whole field. But it does, as I say, very much hold the position of being one of the earliest stories that actually details conflict, not between ourselves, but between human beings and extraterrestrial others and aliens from thence. It's split into two parts, obviously. Serialization, very good. You want to buy the rest of the bits and pieces. Book one and book two. And again, it also ties into, as I said, some of the key areas that we've talked about. That whole notion of prejudices, prejudgments, fears, superstitions. Again, that whole essence of where we're coming. Evolutionary theory, insofar as is that also the way that maybe the Martians actually are superiorly evolved, but then maybe they're not, because actually it's the bacteria that knocks them out of the whole system. Unless, of course, you read Stephen Baxter's sequel, as I say, which opens up another sort of question about what would happen if they kind of learned from Uros and various other aspects within that whole field as well. I talk about this line really because it kind of brings us where we started to, or brings us back to where we started. The whole essence of transcending to cultural icon. We have got stage plays, TV series, movies, Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, music, whole range of other elements, all of which start echoing this whole essence of what Wells has written about. Now, admittedly, there are other things that he's written, Things to Come, which he actually co-produced as a movie in 1936 with Alexander Korda. There were, as I mentioned, The Island of Dr. Moreau, which is often regarded as one of his most popular aspects, which deals with genetic engineering. The Invisible Man, The Misuse of Science, The Time Machine. Again, you could see it very much as a metaphor for what happens when evolution runs unchecked. You get the Eloi, apparently blissful, wonderful people living off the fruit of the planet, etc. But then we find out they're simply being treated as sheep or cattle for the Morlocks, who are running all the technology underground and so on. So the balance there between the Morlocks and the Eloi, etc. And again, something we look at should you actually do the Level 3 SF module. I won't do any more plugs for that, but it's just in line. Anyway, it's a way to go yet. Is it prophetic fiction? Have the Martians landed? Well, no, but it did prefigure two of the bloodiest conflicts of the 20th century in terms of the armed forces and the conflict and the mechanistic conflict of the First World War and the Second World War and the elements relating to that. And arguably, again, the whole notion of superpowered weapons and so on, and the battle that comes through on that basis, which, again, you can argue has helped us get to where we are today, well, hashtag smiley face, or it can actually get to, you know, all sorts of other questions in terms of how we work and develop as human beings and so on. And apart from the whole notion that war literature has its own sort of take in terms of where we're coming from, science fiction also talks about that. I talked again about the comparison with Verne. If pushed, Verne probably was more of an optimistic writer than Wells, although when his nephew effectively shot him, he started becoming quite depressed, as you'd expect, really. And there were sort of other areas, and certainly in his latter years, Verne actually burnt and destroyed a large number of his manuscripts and so on, and there was a sense that, you know, maybe he kind of fallen out of his inspirational line and so on. I'm not saying Wells was miserable, but Wells was basically somebody who would describe as a realist. He would also expand this whole essence of, you know, the universes, etc., that utopian dystopian axis. Everything's wonderful, everything's a disaster. Maybe actually you can almost use the line, one person's utopia is another person's dystopia. What is absolutely perfect to one fantastic meat-eating individual would be absolutely hell to a vegan. You know, again, and vice versa. Again, there are lots of debates and aspects within that. And because it's all about the future, where do we actually go? How do we cope with change? You know, the one thing we can guarantee to everybody in this room is that we are what can develop if you give hydrogen atoms several billion years of evolution to evolve into us. Great, fantastic. But where do we go from here? You know, what's the next stage in development? How do we cope with things relating to climate change? How do we cope with things relating to overpopulation? How do we cope with things relating to ideological conflicts and issues relating to race, religion, and so on? You know, all things that kind of we've revisited in the past, we've been part of, but where are we going to go to within the future, and so on? That's probably something I would like to use as one of the closing quotes in terms of this sort of sequence, by somebody you hopefully will have heard of, director of Alien, of course, and many, many more, including Blade Runner and so on, in a series called Prophets of Science Fiction. That actually, when he's talking about Verne, he keeps one eye on the dark side, but again, celebrating the heart and the possibility of science. But we're focused on H.G. Wells, and I want to conclude by just a few short sentences from the epilogue of The War of the Worlds, which again maybe fits these things into a kind of holistic notion of these. The epilogue. I cannot but regret, now that I am concluding my story, how little I am able to contribute to the discussion of the many debatable questions which are still unsettled. In one respect, I shall certainly provoke criticism. My particular province is speculative philosophy. My knowledge of comparative physiology is confined to a book or two, but it seems to me that Carver's suggestions as to the reason of the rapid death of the Martians is so probable as to be regarded almost as a proven conclusion. I have assumed that in the body of my narrative. At any rate, in all the bodies of the Martians that were examined after the war, no bacteria, except those already known as terrestrial species, were found. That they did not bury any of their dead, and the reckless slaughter they perpetrated, point also to an entire ignorance of the putrefactive process. But probable as this seems, it is by no means a proven conclusion. Technology is there. It opens up a whole range of sort of elements, whether you're dealing with the Nautilus from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, or whether you're dealing with the George Pell version of the H.G. Wells time machine. Time is, as ever, the one resource we should never, ever waste.